to get so angry. It makes me want to cry.
Well, now, when anything bothers me and I'm feeling unhappy, I just try and think of nice things.
What kind of things?
Oh, well, let me see. Nice things. Daffodils. Green meadows. Skies full of stars. Raindrops on roses. And whiskers on kittens, bright copper kettles and warm woolen mittens, brown paper packages tied up with strings. These are a few of my favorite things. Cream-colored ponies and crisp apple strudels, doorbells and sleigh bells and schnitzel with noodles, wild geese that fly with a moon on their wings. These are a few of my favorite things.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
I'm doing part-time.
Part-timefanboy.com.
Yeah, so good way to start off the new year, huh? everyone but you and me bailed out.
That's okay. It's a difficult time around the beginning of the year.
Yeah, I guess so. I've just started to realize that. But this is Part-Time Fanboy. I'm Christian, and that's Paul, although you can't
see
Paul.
Hey, how you doing?
I can see Paul, but you can't see Paul, because this is a podcast.
It's better that way.
It probably is. Yeah, I'm kind of a mess too. What we want to do, or what we were going to do, is do an episode of our favorite things from 2012. And I honestly don't know how prepared I am for this. I've been kind of like thinking about it all week and kind of going through other people's best of lists. But I think I've got enough here to go on or to, you know, discuss for about, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes, an hour. What do you think?
There were plenty of things I loved about last year, so I think that there'll be some good things.
yeah, nice. So which one do you want to start off with? Do you want to start off with that, what you just flashed in front of the screen?
What was that?
Your Avengers Cup.
Oh, yes. We can start with the Avengers. Actually, this is an Alaska Cup.
Oh, it looks like the Avengers.
It totally looks
logo.
Like the Avengers, but I'll rotate that around. It's Alaska.
Yeah, it is an actually Alaska Cup.
The Avengers is a great place to start off, I think, because if anything, last year was definitely sort of a new high watermark for superhero movies.
Yeah.
I was actually planning on starting with another superhero movie, but you know, all roads sort of lead back to the Avengers.
Yeah,
That movie really did a fantastic job of sort of resetting things from the grim and gritty, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it was just a marvelous piece of entertainment. I've seen it about three or four times this year, twice in the theater and then a couple of times on home video now. And I still call it home video.
We're old.
But, you know, it never ceases to be entertaining. It's just a solid piece of work from beginning to end.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, you know me and you know my schedule, and I barely get out to see movies like in theaters these days at all. Mm-hmm. And God, I gotta say, like, I really loved that movie. And it's not, most of it had to do with, like you said, the positivity of it. Like, it wasn't mm-hmm. grim and gritty, and they were having fun, and it basically set out what it needed to do, right? I mean, it
told absolutely
a good story. It pulled all those movies together in a coherent way. Mm-hmm. I think even if maybe you had missed like one or two of those movies, you wouldn't have needed to see them. And
right,
you know, they kind of set it up to build like a big film Marvel universe, you know what I mean? I saw it three times in the theater. Like, when was the last time I ever did that?
Yeah, exactly. And it's a movie that really succeeds on its own terms, too. I mean, honestly, I don't think you necessarily had to have seen any of them going in.
Probably
although,
not.
You know, probably most people who did, you know, had seen the others. But, you know, it just really was an entertaining movie in its own right. And it was, like I said, a solid piece of writing. It was well acted. The special effects were, you know, marvelous. The Hulk is a seamless special effect. For the first time. And, you know, it's sort of the superhero movie that all of the others have been building up to, not just the Marvel movies in a lot of ways, but I knew that we were in for a good start of the year when Chronicle came.
Yes,
out.
Yeah, that's on my list too.
You know, that's that was just another marvelous superhero movie.
Yeah, that had nothing to do with Marvel.
That had nothing to do with Marvel, right? Yeah. But first of all, what I love is that it made the found footage genre interesting.
Yeah, which, they pulled it off.
Which, I mean, that's a feat in and itself, you know?
Yeah.
It brought, in a way, it sort of was a little Marvel-ish because, you know, how Marvel sort of brought the everyman teenager sort of into it at the time with Spider-Man and,
yeah,
you know, made more realistic characters. Well, this was sort of an update of, you know, a realistic superhero movie.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because I think I heard there was an argument at some convention where Max Brooks was kind of saying that it wasn't a superhero movie, or somebody was trying to defend it as not a superhero movie. And I mean, it is and it isn't, but like the thing about Chronicle, like you said, it pulled off the found footage thing really well. And quite honestly, that's sort of a thing that I only see really works that well for horror. So,
mm-hmm.
But they used that little gimmick of him, you know, telekinetically carrying the camera around, like wherever he
right.
was, to be able to pull that sort of thing off. And I love the bit about like him having a really crappy camera in the beginning, and then it gets
mm-hmm.
damaged, and somebody gets him a really nice camera towards the end, and then the footage gets better looking and stuff like that. And it's just a really good character piece, really good acting from everyone involved, and just solid writing. And that got the year started off really well. And I didn't think I was going to like it from the trailers, but I kept hearing about a lot of good things from a lot of people I trust, you being one of them.
Well, and after hearing that fantastic rant that Max Landis did about the death of Superman.
Well, I didn't see that till after I saw that. It's brilliant.
Yeah, I knew that, you know, we would be in good hands, you know, in terms of the story, because obviously he's a guy who loves comic books. He's a guy who thinks about his comic books.
Yeah.
And, you know, to have somebody, you know, with that kind of a pedigree who actually cares about the material, you
sure.
know, on hand, that was really a joy.
Yeah.
It's probably one of my, you know, three or four favorite movies of the year.
Yeah, definitely. And it really, the thing that I really liked about it was that it really put you in the seat of the person being affected, like almost like Marvel's did, you know,
mm-hmm.
where you were the person that was being affected by the person with the superpowers. So I remember specifically the scene where they're in the car, and I can't remember, I think it was a Volkswagen Bug or something like that, and they're being lifted above Seattle.
Right.
And the girl is screaming in the car. Like, that's the very first time I remember thinking, like, wow, this is what it must be like for Lois Lane. Like, this
right.
is exactly what it must, and it sucks. Like, I would not want to be in that position ever, you know? And she's just screaming her head off. And you really, they really did put you, I don't know, was that released in 3D?
No, it wasn't.
Yeah, no, but
I'm
glad.
Like it.
Yeah, it did. You felt like you were in it. Like, you felt like you were in that moment where you were being lifted in the car, and it was like, oh my God, like, this shit's about, you're going to get dropped. Like, I remember getting that feeling of height. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that the found footage is what did that, you know, because it's a genre that, if it's done really well, does really pull you into the psychology of the characters who are
Absolutely.
Involved. And it was marvelous. And it set up, and I felt in its own way, it set up the Avengers, even though it had nothing to do
sure.
With the Avengers, you know, like, it sort of raised the bar again on what a superhero movie could be.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, you know, by the time Avengers rolls around, it was like, okay, well, we're going to, you know, we're going to raise the bar again on everything, including Chronicle. And, the Avengers is, in a way, a small miracle.
Yeah, it really is. I think that they should all be commended for pulling that off. And I got to say, like, with the Avengers, when I went into that theater, I was like, please don't suck. Just please, just entertain mm-hmm. me. I just don't want it to suck. And there was a big part of me that was like, I want it to be unique enough in its own way so that I can go like, this was a lot of fun. I wasn't looking for Lawrence of Arabia. I wasn't looking for, you know, whatever, you know, the mm-hmm. Matrix. I was just looking for something that was going to be fun and entertaining. And by the end of that movie, I was just thrilled. I was just so happy. And I can't remember the last time I came out of a theater and I was like, that was just so like out of a superhero action movie that mm-hmm. I just came out and I was like, that was spectacular. Like that was, it did what it was supposed to do. They nailed it on the head and I was very happy, very happy. So yeah, I mean, Chronicle and the Avengers, two great movies this year that, you know, you and I both loved. So, I mean, those were two huge highlights of, you know, 2012. But mm-hmm. Another movie that I think was a big highlight that I didn't get to see until it came out on video was The Raid. The Raid was fantastic. Yeah. Another great film.
That was really, really an amazing piece of work too. Yeah. And you know, they just announced that they're going ahead with a sequel.
Really?
Yeah, they'll be making a sequel that begins, like, I believe that according to the news article I read, it's going to begin about 20 minutes after the end of the first movie.
Wow. How do you do that?
It's going to be expanding it out. So now instead of fighting his way, you know, up a building, he's going to be fighting his way across the city.
That's crazy. That's pretty awesome. That's awesome. Well, this was just like, I mean, like I said, when I finally ended up seeing it and you guys, you and Ian had talked about it on our podcast a little bit because I hadn't had a chance to see it. But this is one of those movies that very much breath of fresh air. I mean, it's hyper violent and stuff, but it's kind of like a cartoon. You can't really take it too seriously and you can't really take the story. It's just an ultimate like fighting action flick.
Yeah. And it's a style of martial arts. I think it's called Silat. From Indonesia that you don't really see in I know that most people here in the West haven't seen this style of fighting before, and so it's a unique fresh style of fighting. The cinematography in this thing was just amazing. You always knew where you were inside of that building and you were able to keep track of multiple characters in multiple locations. There was never any shaky cam footage. It was all really still, just like classically good fight scene. You know, I mean, I honestly, this stuff holds up to you know, any classic kung fu or karate movie.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, it surpasses a lot of them, I think. I just, and that's a good point, that the camera, while not always stationary, but everything is visible. And that's something that movies are, I understand the chaos of sort of a quote unquote real fight, you know what I mean? But that you see everything. And so many American action movies have been embracing this sort of, you know, shaky cam thing, which I'm a big fan of if it's done well, but it is really nice to be able to see all the movements, you know, and everything moving around. So
and just geography is a key thing with any kind of an action movie. It's why the first Die Hard movie works so well. Is that you have a feeling for the building and you know where people are, and you know people don't just suddenly, you know, turn a corner and they're in a different part of the building. Which, funny enough, the movie that we also loved that gets compared to The Raid a lot, Dread, was also the same way. You know, those two movies for me are like bookends in a way. It's like it's amazing that they both came out at the same time or around the same time with a very similar type of story, but two completely different movies.
And
you know, both of them just top notch, you know, well made. And both of them, you know, somewhat low budget. You know, Dread was obviously much higher budget than The Raid was.
Yeah.
But you know, this was a good year for action. You know, not just superhero action. Although Dread sort of, you know, overlaps both of them, but you know, this year really was a solid year for movies. I have very few complaints about the movies that I saw this year.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm a little different because there were a couple of, one sort of big disappointment to me, but one, you know, slight disappointment. I wouldn't even say disappointment, but I've talked about it before. But yeah, Dread was a really great surprise because we went in, we did that kind of as a work outing, like after work. We're like, let's go see Dread, you know. For some reason, we had heard about it and we were all joking about it because of the Stallone movie. And we were very much like, let's go see that, you know, thinking, not really expecting much. And actually one of the few movies that I actually intentionally went in to see in 3D lately, and just really loving it. I mean, Carl Urban, he just does a great job. And I forget the actress's name, but like we said when we reviewed it on the podcast, she's kind of the linchpin that holds that thing together. And I really hope they do another one. I would go see a sequel. I would absolutely go see a sequel to Dread.
Right. And well, you know, and even if they don't manage to get a, you know, to get another one off the ground for a while, because, you know, these properties will, some of the properties probably will sit for a while.
Sure.
But when people come back to them, you know, again, the bar has been raised. I mean, granted, you didn't have to raise the bar very high off of that Stallone one.
Yeah.
If somebody does choose to go back to that material, you know, now they've got a really great place to start.
Yeah, you're right. They've got a good takeoff point, you know, or something to look at that can give them a good blueprint, you know. And Dread actually is coming out on Blu-ray next week.
And good.
It's one of the, I don't know if this is a common occurrence, but they are not, it looks like, at least on Amazon, they're not selling a separate 3D, 2D Blu-ray. It's the 3D version and the 2D version on one disc,
which
I have not seen, which makes the whole package a little more expensive. But I think, you know, maybe I'll buy a used version of it when it comes out, because I really liked it. I mean, that for me is a Blu-ray purchase. So
yeah, I did too. So outside of movies, which have just been pretty awesome, I know that there are a couple of, you know, sort of latecomers for me too, Django Unchained.
I haven't seen it.
Yeah, I did. I went to go see it in a casino theater in Laughlin, Nevada.
Nice.
Yeah. It would have been nice. Let's just put it this way. There was probably a sizable contingent of the audience that was rooting for the Leonardo DiCaprio
Slave
Plantation.
God, that's horrible.
There were a lot of Stars and Bars stickers in the on the cars in the casino parking lot. And it was a little bit horrible because you'll see the, I'm not spoiling anything here to say that, you know, Jamie Foxx's character Django, you know, the who's a freed slave, starts fighting back.
Yeah.
And there were people who walked out of the theater when he started fighting back. And,
really?
Yes, it was amazing to see, like, just the amount of naked racism that's still going on. And one thing I really appreciate about the, you know, because there, you know, obviously there's a big controversy about the movie right now, is, you know, that, you know, Tarantino lays it out, you know, I mean, he's very sort of plain about it, you know, about, like, this is, that slavery was an institution that just destroyed everyone that it touched.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, honestly, I don't think it's so much of a controversy for me because, like, clearly, you know, the bigots in this movie are fools, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's quite clear. The bigots in the movies are fools, you know, and then there are, like, people who are absolute heroes in the movie.
Yeah.
But, But we as a, you know, as a nation haven't really ever come to grips with all this stuff. And, and that's still really clear.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I heard a bit of an interview about the movie on Fresh Air when I was in D.C. I was driving on an errand, and they had an interview with him. It just happened to be on the radio when I was driving, you know, separate from my family. And, you know, obviously I've heard about the controversy, but, you know, Tarantino definitely seems unapologetic and is like, look, this is the way it kind of was. You know, it's like you can't gloss over that. And it's sort of like, you know.
And another thing to keep in mind, too, is that this isn't necessarily a movie about American history as much as it's a movie about movies about American history, you know, because he makes sort of meta movies, movies about other movies. And this is, more than anything, this is sort of like a take on Westerns.
Yeah.
You know, and it's an incredible piece of work. I'm not going to say, you know, it's his best movie, because I think that I think his best movie actually may be ahead of him, you know.
I hope so.
But it's definitely a daring, interesting movie. It's never dull, and it's never less than interesting.
So how does this compare to, say, like Inglourious Bastards? Because liked Inglourious Bastards, but I didn't think it was his best.
I think that it's pretty similar. I feel like and this is just me and me probably being weird a little bit. I definitely miss his editor, Sally Menke.
Oh, okay.
She passed away this this last year, and that was really a sad thing. And I feel like it's not his tightest edited movie.
Uh-huh.
You know, but that, you know, that might be just me.
Nitpicking.
But it's still strong. I mean, the script is pretty amazing. I'm actually reading the script right now since I've seen the movie.
Cool.
And seeing the choices that he made, you know, in terms of moving some of the material around, eliminating some of the other material. You know, it's really the guy's researched and wrestled with this material for some time. So,
yeah, yeah.
I think it's something that is definitely worth seeing. It's not obviously, it's one of those movies that makes you really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I saw it in about probably the most uncomfortable setting that I could have seen this. But it's definitely worth seeing.
That's cool.
And it's strong. It ends up on my sort of top whatever list.
Well, Tarantino, I think, is always going to end up on a top whatever. I mean, the guy's a genius as far as I'm concerned. But any other like big movie picks off the top of your head that like really impressed you this year? I mean, obviously there's a long list that we could go over, but
But I mean, let's try moving outside of the movies for a little while.
Yeah, sure. You know, oh, absolutely. Let's move on to like TV. I can tell you what my favorite thing that happened in TV was the return of Breaking Bad.
Mine too. That was a really, really amazing show. And now that they're sort of bringing everything to a close, it's really cool to see them moving the pieces in place for what's going to be sort of the big epic ending.
Yeah, well, the thing that and the reason that I mentioned Breaking Bad, because Breaking Bad obviously is, I mean, it's a great show, and it could be on any top 10 list. You know, I mean, it is. Mm-hmm. But the way that they kind of pulled it off, because at the end of the season before this past one, it seemed like that should have been the end to me, where they kind of shook hands on the roof, and, you know, the big drug dealer had been eliminated, and it seemed like they were going to go their separate ways. And is it Vince Gilligan or Gilligan, the creator?
Gilligan,
he managed to find a way to make it plausible to pull everyone back into the action again. And that's why I think this season was so great, because I was very worried. I was thinking, how are they going to pull this off? What are they going to do? Because honestly, Breaking Bad is probably now top three TV shows of all time for me. And it's been consistently solid. And this season, they didn't change that at all. Like the acting is still solid. The writing is still solid. Obviously, there's, like any TV show, there's a lot of implausibilities, but not so much that it made me go, you know.
Right.
It was very, very, very solid, like, and through the whole way through, and I absolutely just loved the whole thing, and very happy that they were able to pull that off. I'm a little pissed that they split it up into, you know, two parts so they could have more, you know, time with it for next year, but
right.
Whatever. I mean, what aired, which was, I think, 8 episodes, was so terrifically fantastic that, I mean, it just has to go, like, on the top of my list, you know?
Yeah. It's quality all the way. And, you know, on one that's going to be on my top two is one that you recommended to me. I watched American Horror Story, that first season.
Yeah.
There, and man, wow, that was really something.
Are you talking about this past season or the first season?
The first season.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, you know, that was really an interesting piece of work. There were a few moments that were even really sort of shocking and surprising, you know, for me. And, you know, and since, you know how it is with horror people, you know.
It takes
a lot to sort of shock and, like, scare us. But, you know, there were definite moments of, like, real creepiness.
Yeah.
In it. Jessica Lange, wow.
Yeah.
You know,
awesome, like
simultaneously, like, just single-handedly, like, sort of resurrecting the sort of, you know, gothic southern matriarch, scary woman there, you know, the sort of the Tennessee Williams character come to life. I mean, just a really cool performance that just threatens to go over the top at every single level, but she doesn't do it, you know?
Yeah.
You know, she manages to make it believable and scary. Really, really a great performance.
Yeah.
And the best thing I've ever seen, oh, crap, I'm going to get his name wrong. It's either Dylan McDermott or Dermot Mulroney. Which one is it?
Dermot, I don't know. You know, we know who you're talking about, the lead.
Yeah, I think it's Dylan McDermott. Yeah, the best thing I've ever seen him do.
And, yeah, absolutely, you know, the best thing I've ever seen. And he's a solid actor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, prepare yourself for season two, because I think season two, this past season, I mean, we're talking about our favorite things. Let's just say that the last 4 episodes are still sitting on our DVR. Season two kind of goes off in a whole other direction, which is what it was supposed to do. Yeah, it's a new story, but with some of the same actors.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, you know how you said, like, the first season kind of threatened to go over the top a little bit.
Does this one follow through on that?
The second season goes right off the effing cliff, if you know what I'm saying. Like, unbelievably so. Where I kind of was, you know, our friend Miguel at Dig Comics, he was...
Sure.
I don't think he had seen the first season, and on Facebook he made a comment about it, like, kind of trashing the sexuality of it. And I was... Uh-huh. I defended it. And that wasn't what I had a problem with. I just think that there was no subtlety at all in the second season, whereas in the first season, they really kept an even keel where, like you said, there were points where it threatened to kind of go overboard, and then they pulled back. This time, they did not pull back at all. It's just, like, in your face, over the top, slam-bang editing, which I think Amy liked it more than I did. But I was very much kind of disappointed. If they do a third season, I'll definitely check it out, and I got to watch these last 4 episodes. But I was definitely disappointed, so, well, I don't know.
The first season ends up on my list, so.
Yeah, the first season. But what'd you think about that finale?
I thought the finale made sense in terms of the context of the, you know, the whole season.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's sort of the whole premise of the show is that you essentially create your own heaven or hell,
you know,
for yourself, in this, at least in the terms of this house.
Yeah.
You know, it made sense. You know, it was a little, you know, they did sort of tie everything together a little too neatly in a way with the family dynamics that were going on with that particular group. But, you know, it, I didn't I didn't begrudge it the ending. You know, sure. I felt like they had sort of gotten to their place where they had said what they wanted to say, and they kind of wanted to go out on a happy ending. Okay, that's fine. Although, you know, that didn't necessarily ring true with the rest of the season.
Oh, it drove me crazy, Paul. I was losing my mind watching that last episode. I was like, what are you doing? What are you doing? Stop! Stop it! Like, it was such a good show. And then that last episode just tacked on this like neat little Christmas happy ending, and they were so obviously trying to force a Christmas episode into it. And I'm like, I mean, you could ask Amy, I was literally yelling at the TV, like, what are you doing? No, stop, stop it, stop it, stop it, just over and over again. Oh, and then, and you know, but like I said, like, and like I said to you, it was such a solid, you know, debut that, I watched the second season, and I'll watch probably the third season, even though the second was a little bit of a disappointment.
I'll be honest with you. I don't know if I'm up for another season of it, but you know, it was the first one was good enough on its own terms for me to be like, okay, yeah, you know, I didn't feel like I wasted, you know, what, 9 hours of my time.
Yeah, that's great.
Anything else for TV for you?
Oh yeah, season? I've got a couple. Well, I'm going to pick one that isn't necessarily fanboyish, but okay. I was impressed with this year, and it's a reality show. Survivor this year was, I loved it, and Amy loves this show. She watches it. She's watched every season.
Mm-hmm.
And there have definitely, you know, and I'll sit and watch with her. It's not that I don't like the show. I'm fine with it. I'm not anti-reality show. But for some reason, the past several years, I haven't been that much into it. Like, I'll sit and watch it, but I'll usually be doing something else, like doodling or writing a review or something. And but this season, I was really drawn into it because they put on they had Blair from the Facts of Life on it. I don't know about you, but growing up I was so hot for Blair on the Facts of Life.
I was more of a Joe man myself.
I liked Joe too, but something about Blair, even though she was a bitch, I really really was crazy about her. But it wasn't even that. It was just.
I gotta admit, I liked her a lot better after they went to Paris and she did that little walk around Paris and fell in love with the city. I did enjoy her character much more after that.
I can't even remember that, but no, I mean it. The interesting thing was the fact that she was kind of very open on that show about what she was like, and just the thing that kept me enwrapped in it was that, when is she going to get voted off? You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, when is she? Because as soon as she got voted off, I was very much like, I don't know if I'm interested in this anymore. And she hung on the whole way through till the end. Now, spoilers, she didn't win, you know, but either way, I was just very impressed with the whole thing and how she kind of held herself. I mean, she did come across a little crazy, but it was very interesting to see a little bit of how she lost her money. You know, she's not wealthy, you know, to a certain extent. And
well, what I think is fascinating was just how, because I watched the season too. I'm sort of in the same boat as you are. My wife is a huge fan of the show.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, I think it's probably the best of the reality shows along with Amazing Race, you know.
Yeah,
and I do like it, you know, it's a good way to, you know, to kill an hour or so. And,
but
you're right. This season was really especially good because of her, because no one else, I think, has really shown like sort of what this game, what the game does to you inside.
Yeah.
I mean, it was almost like it was like you were like reading someone's diary.
Yeah.
In a way, you know, in the way that she was, you know, she was genuinely conflicted because of, you know, who she thinks she is and how she feels like she needs to portray herself.
Sure.
And, you know, and then, you know, she's got the whole Christian element going on too, which was a fantastic, I mean, that was really interesting to see someone who, you know, they want to live up to a certain moral code, but they're playing a game that demands that you sort of step outside that code.
Yeah.
And she was really articulate at, you know, expressing these conflicts, you know, the whole way, and really open, and, you know, I was really impressed with the way that the first of all that you know not just her but the way they put it together this season.
Yeah.
You know, by featuring her, you know, her struggles as they go through, and you know, it's one of the rare seasons too where when you got to that end there and you have your like three people, you know, who it could be, where I was just like, yeah, it could be any one of these people, you know, they've all sort of fought really hard to get there. And
yeah.
I respected, you know, the game that all of them played.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, going back a little bit to the Blair thing, Lisa Welschel, I don't know exactly how you pronounce
right.
her last name, but the thing that was really compelling about it, you know, on top of what you just said too, was how much being on this show, you know, brought back like the whole, all the issues that she had while she was on The Facts of Life, you know what I'm
mm-hmm.
saying? And learning how crazy that sort of, why she walked away from it and why she wasn't interested in living that Hollywood lifestyle anymore, you know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
And how much she felt like being on this reality show kind of almost dragged her back into that space, and she didn't want to be that person anymore, you know?
Yeah, I get it.
You know, and it's really interesting to always see somebody who kind of, you know, when you see a celebrity or an interview with a celebrity and it's like that didn't necessarily get forced out, but was like, or may have been forced out, but to a certain extent, it's just like, you know what, I just walked away. I didn't want to do it anymore. And as somebody who, me personally, who pursued an acting career for a time and got to a point where it's just like, I don't want to do this anymore. You know, I'm tired of this, you know.
Yeah.
I could sort of relate to that. So I was kind of like relating to her, obviously never reaching a point of stardom anywhere close. But as someone who would work on little projects every once in a while, getting to a point of where it's like, you know what, this is kind of bullshit. I don't care anymore, you know.
Yeah.
And what it's does to you mentally. I very much related to that. So, yeah, so that was my, but we can't leave off. Do you have any other TV picks? Any big,
what
about Doctor Who? I mean, it wasn't
Doctor
my
Who's,
favorite.
Doctor Who was, you know, a good season. I'm more excited about the upcoming season.
Oh, so
you know, because it's always good when, you know, you shake things up. And, you know, honestly, if you think about the David Tennant years, you know, things really started getting really good for him as the Doctor when they finally ended up sort of, you know, changing the companions and things like that, you know, and like he really sort of came into his own there. And so, yeah, I think this will be a really positive thing going forward.
That was one of my, I'll say this. One of my favorite things of 2012 was the ousting of Amy Pond. I hated Amy Pond. You know, I couldn't stand her. Her last episode was one of the lamest Doctor Who, like with the statues and the, you know, them being stuck in a hotel for all time. I hated that. I just, it just seemed like a companion that they set up, and she never really, for me, she never really gelled. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
She just never, and I think that part of it was, I really wish that they had gotten rid of Amy Pond and kept Rory. Like, why couldn't he have a male companion? Like, if Amy Pond had died or something and Rory been the companion for a long time, that I would have loved that, because, like, I loved Rory. I loved him. I thought he was great.
I think he's fantastic. As you know, he's still my pick for the next James Bond.
Yeah,
so.
And I just really think that, like, she wasn't a good enough actress in the beginning, and I don't think her character ever really gelled. And I think part of it has to do with the fact that these new writers or new creators of Doctor Who, at least in this modern era, they need Doctor Who to be able to flirt or play with the Doctor. You know what I'm saying?
Right,
You know, they need for them to, you need to have an actress who can do that, who can engage him and sort of be on his level. And Amy Pond never really did that. And with her being married and does she love Rory, blah, 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 it kind of was a little too intrusive. You know what I'm saying?
A little soap opera-y, you know, in a bad way. Yeah.
Yeah. and very distracting to me. So that was one of my big favorite things of 2012 was Amy Pond, you're the fuck out, and now you've got the cute brunette in who can, you know, deliver the moonlighting style dialogue, you know what I'm saying, the rat-tat-tat, mm-hmm. and go back and forth. And that is one of the things that I loved about, gonna forget her, redhead, Tennant's last companion.
Kathleen.
Kathleen. Anyway, her, that was, and Rose and Martha too, they could all engage him, and now it looks like we're sort of back to that. And that's the thing, is I was never down on Matt Smith. I mean, in the beginning I was, but when they did that one episode where he moves in with the dude for like a little while, he moves in with the sort of heavy set dude who's kind of not, and it was just Matt Smith and she was not in the episode. I was like, this guy's got it. They need to get rid of Amy.
Catherine Tate,
bam, you nailed it. When they did that, when they put put him alone with someone, you started seeing how great Matt Smith was. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And, thank God. I thought Amy Pond was going to be in it for a long time. So, but, yes, I'm so happy right now. Just thinking how she's gone, it makes me happy. But I can't leave off the 2012 TV stuff without mentioning one thing that I loved more than anything, which is the episode of Mad Men, where she sings to Don Draper, Zooby Zooby Zoo. Zooby Zooby Zoo. I love that. I don't know why. It still pops into my head. It's not even like the little dance or singing or whatever that she did. It's just that song was perfect and it just sticks in your head. And
First of all, you know you would have given anything to go to that party.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
I mean, it's kind of funny because, like, I Mad Men is a favorite show of mine too.
Sure. But
like that party, you know, that night was just they did a fantastic job of sort of capturing, you know, sort of a magical, you know, city party where everyone's there and having a good time, and it was sort of a standout episode. And for some reason, I remember everyone after that episode, like, Facebook just blew up on the, you know, Zooby Zooby Zoo.
Zooby Zooby Zoo. I love it.
And I totally get that. I'm looking forward to a lot of TV in 2013. I like Justified quite a bit. That's a great show. If you haven't, catch up. The second season of that is easily the best. One of the best villains on television. Justified's a great show. I probably spend more time, you know, watching like TV than anything else. Even on network TV, Person of Interest is a fantastic show.
I've heard different things, but I've heard that it's mostly solid.
It's a very solid show. You know, it's Jonathan Nolan who put it together. And essentially it's Batman on TV in a way. It's the sort of the Nolan-esque Batman-driven underground in a way.
Cool.
It's a solid TV show. You know, it's got some weak moments, just like anything in you know, certainly network stuff, but overall, you know, it's an entertaining show. Cool. And there's a lot of good TV out right now.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of good TV out. Walking Dead made a comeback this year.
Holy
cow.
And what a comeback that was too.
Yeah.
You know, that was a really strong, I really wanted to stop watching after The Farm.
Yeah.
You know, and then, like, you know, revealing that they're going to do the prison again, I was just like, oh God, it's going to be The Farm, you know, but with bars.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, that first episode came out swinging and, you know, they didn't stop.
They did a really good job of, not making the mistake that the comics made, which is keeping them in the prison sort of forever. You know, that's what the mistake that the comics made, and when I almost dropped the comics. And now with this season, they've really, you know, I don't know. It's just, I posted it on Facebook after, you know, spoiler, get ready to not listen. After Lori died, I was like, this show grew up like right away. Like babies all growed up, you know, like it definitely hit a whole other, you know, level this season. And I hope that, you know, apparently the current showrunner is going to be leaving next season.
Yeah.
Not for this next batch of episodes that is airing. I think it may start up in
January.
But
it's going to be for the fourth season, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Which is kind of a disappointment because I think he did a really good job, at least this season. So, but yeah, so this year is the year that that Walking Dead, you know, finally broke through. And I was like, all right, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I read something online where they were comparing that to, you know, here, look at this delicious cake that we've made for you. And, you know, it's incredibly frosted. It's the most delicious cake ever. Yeah, by the way, we fired the chef that made this
for you. I know, right? Well, they did it with Darabont. And now the next guy's leaving. So there's got to be something going on at AMC, right?
It's Don Draper, man. Don Draper, like, can't stand the competition, and he's whacking them left and right.
Well, it's interesting because there have been some shows complaining about the fact that they think that that Mad Men is really sucking up all of AMC's budgetary money. So I don't know.
Well, you know, look, I don't begrudge Mad Men, you know, the success, because I think it's a fantastic show.
Me too.
But you know what? They paid $250,000 to use that Beatles song at the end of that episode. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's the most money ever spent on, you know, on a single song use for entertainment purposes, like film or television. And it's like, yeah, you know, $250,000 for what, 3 minutes of of television, just for the music, for 3 minutes of television, you know, that eats up a lot of change, you know.
That's crazy. That almost rings of like Veruca Salt, like, I want a new blooper and I want it now, you know, like, I've got to have that Beatles song. Wow, I didn't know that. That's crazy. So that, who knows what they're spending other money on then, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Cigarettes, man. Cigarettes and booze.
Cigarettes. Well, let's move on to comics, because you and I both love comics.
Yep.
And I know that we've made a lot of recommendations over the years, but there's definitely stuff I've forgotten about, you know, on our recommendations lists or holiday lists. Do you have any big comics recommendations that you had for this year? Like, any great reads?
Great read. See, you know, I'm actually catching up on the Walking Dead stuff. You remember I bought all those trades when we were at Comic-Con.
Yeah.
So I'm catching up on that. It's so funny. It's like, for my comic reading, I feel like I'm so far behind in terms of like things that are in print. But I read all the time stuff that's online, like online comics.
Oh yeah.
So
yeah, that's great.
I mean, that's most of the stuff that I'm reading these days are things that are, you know, sort of online or you know, reprints or, you know, things of older comics. You know, I'm working my way through Sandman Mystery Theater, which, you know, that was a great book written by Matt Wagner. You know, that's...
Oh, yeah, Sandman Mystery Theater is fantastic. I love the artist. I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but I got to start... I picked up the first trade of that a long time ago. I got to read that. Well, I've got some...
You know, All-Star Superman, you know, I'm still finishing that up.
Oh, yeah. That was a great book. Yeah, I mean, regarding 2012... there was some good stuff that came out this year, and I'll just, you know, talk a little bit about it. In the beginning of the year, IDW released the first sort of, I guess they're called Ultimate Collections, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. They are these, they're these beautiful hardcover reproductions of the original Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles comics, and Volume 1 came out like on January 10th or 1st or something of last year, like right in the beginning of last year, and at least according to Amazon's page. And I ordered it because I'd always been curious about the original comics. I'd never seen them, and I didn't know much about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles other than the movie, which I really liked when I saw it in the theater. And I actually bought it for cheap, like, I don't know where I was, a Best Buy or something. I saw it for like $6, and I watched it again, and I actually thought it kind of held up. So I'd always been kind of curious about the Ninja Turtles, and also from the perspective of, wow, these guys did their own thing, came out of nowhere, and now they're just bajillionaires, you know?
Right, right. I remember, you know, the old black and white, you know, like crappily printed Ninja Turtles. I still have some of them somewhere, you know, but they were really entertaining books, and, you know, certainly a lot more, like, you know, gritty and darker than, you know, the kids' stuff, than the, by the time the cartoon and movies rolled around, you know.
Like, yeah.
You know, one of the jokes, like when I went to Australia, like that was, for some reason, that was they thought, like, that was how we talked, you know. they thought that we were all like, cowabunga, dude.
Yeah, that's so funny. Pizza.
You know, like that was, you know, they were incredibly influential. I'd love to go back and, like, sort of see those, you know, those cool stories. I remember they did a lot of, like, sort of space story, outer space stories and things like that. It's like, you know, they're really, really ambitious for something that somebody was doing out of their garage.
Yeah. I mean, it really is. I mean, I remember getting the first volume and opening it up and kind of taking a quick look at the art and being like, uh-oh. Like, it's really raw stuff, underground stuff, which is not always what I'm drawn to. But I will say that once I sat down and started reading them, they were fantastic, and I picked up the second one. I want to order the third one as soon as I get a chance, because I haven't even started reading the second one. But I really, really loved it, and I can see how they would have taken off in the culture of the time in the 80s. And I was very taken aback by how much I loved it. And IDW did, I mean, there's commentary after every issue by Eastman and Laird. Yeah, and it's just, they did a really good job of putting together a really neat package. And it seems like they're just going down the line. There's a third one, and there's going to be a fourth one. And just really solid stuff that I really enjoyed. And it's really funny because there's all these, like, little in-jokes about Marvel Comics, like references, like somebody's named Baxter, and obviously their origin is tied into, like, Daredevil's origin, you know.
Right.
So there's all these, like, really great, like, little things. And this was definitely, you know, besides the Flash Gordon books from Titan Books, which I absolutely loved, and that is probably, like, my top, you know, pick of the year. But the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles collections that IDW is putting out, they're so great. I can't recommend them enough.
And speaking of IDW, I just took a look at their website, and I see that they are going to be re-releasing the Thunder Agents.
Yeah?
Yeah, the ones by Wally Wood and Steve Ditko and all those guys. Those were really, really good books. I remember I was only able to get a hold of, like, one or two, but the ones that I read were really, really interesting. I'm looking forward to sort of going back and checking those all out again.
Something to look forward to. That's for next episode. But what are they going to go for?
Doesn't say yet.
Oh, it doesn't say? Oh, man.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so that was a really big thing that made an impression on me early in the year as far as comics went. I mean, it's retro, but it is a new collection that was published last year, so maybe I'm cheating a little bit. The other thing that I really loved was, I'm going to pick it up and show it to you on the camera. Not everyone can see it. It's cool. Jim Henson's Tale of Sand. And something that, have you read this thing?
I did. I saw it at the comic store, and I just sort of sat down and, like, looked through it. It is amazing.
It is unbelievable. And it's really funny because we've talked about our picks and things that we loved and comics that we recommend that maybe people don't know about. This thing is, I can't express it enough. It is gorgeous. It is probably one of the most gorgeous comics I've laid my eyes on in a long time. The artist's name is Ramon K. Perez, and it is basically, it's from Archaea Press, and I guess Jim Henson and his writing partner, I'm going to mispronounce this, Jerry Joel, they did a screenplay that they never produced, that Jim Henson never produced, and I guess, I don't know if Archaea or who got their act together to produce this into a graphic novel, but it's fantastic. I mean, this is, when you talk about high-class comics, this is high-class. Like, this is the high end of the bar. This is not, they're not messing around, and I know that some people have been turned off by it because there is a lack of dialogue. The story structure is a little all over the place. It is not like your typical ABC plot, but...
No, yeah.
But it is probably one of the more stunning works of art that I've had a chance to look at in a long time. And when I was sitting there thinking about, like, gosh, what was great last year? This just popped out on my shelf. It was sitting on my bookshelf. And I said, that's it. That is the one big pick that I have not talked about, written about, you know, or anything.
Yeah.
So if you are a fan of this guy, Ramon K. Perez, he does an online comic book that he hasn't touched, actually two, and I can't remember the names of them, but I remember discovering his online comics a long time ago and being just incredibly jealous as to how fantastic his artwork is. And but this, I mean, if this doesn't win like a whole bunch of Eisners or
right,
you know, or whatever awards, I there's something wrong with the industry, because this is the real deal. This is a fantastic, I mean, it's a work of art. It's a work of art. You can't get
and,
past
and like
it.
I said, you know, the it's the first thing that I can remember in years that, like, I just sat down, like, I saw it on the shelf and I'm like, I have to read this.
Yeah.
You know, I have to.
Yeah.
And you know, I haven't done that probably since Preacher.
Yeah.
Or Transmet or something like that, you know.
Yeah.
It just immediately said, you know, read me.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
I don't know about you, but I actually did find it very readable and very interesting, you know, despite the, there literally is nothing else like it out there, and it really, really made me miss Jim Henson.
Yeah, yeah. I think the challenge of it is that this is a type of book, it's really funny, because you would think that if you, the more words that are in a book, the more you have to focus on it. And this is the type of thing that you have to sit down. You can't, like, sit and read it in front of the TV or, like, on the lunch break at work. You've got to really take the time to sit and focus on it, because it really, it's not panel, you know, it's not a grid. It's not, each page doesn't lead softly into one of, it demands your attention. And that's what's fantastic about it. I mean, it's just, it's unbelievable. It's breathtaking. And this is definitely, I mean, one of my top picks of the year. It's one of those books that just kind of, it makes you jealous when you look at it. You're like, oh, you bastard. You're just like, oh, I'll never be able to do anything as good as this. Like, it's just, oh, it's so great. It's so great. So I guess that, you know, that's my big rant on that. And then, as far as just, like, general comics are concerned, I did stop reading regular books this year, but, you know, a comic company that's really impressed me is Image Comics. They've been doing such a good job lately of putting out different kinds of comic books. You know, they have their superhero books, they have sci-fi books, they have, you know, all these different things, and they've just, like, I just read over the holidays the first collected book of the Manhattan Projects, and Paul, if you have not read, you got to pick up this trade. I already pre-ordered the second trade on Amazon. I said, F it, I'm just going to buy it. Like, it's just fantastic. So they've got the Manhattan Projects, Glory, Saga, like, all these fantastic creator-owned books that, you know, some of them are detective books, some of them are sci-fi, some of them are future alien. You know, I mean, they're just doing so much exciting stuff. And Image Books, Image Comics is it's one of the things I feel sad about when I go into a comic shop and I don't collect regular books anymore, and I look at the individual issues and I go, man, I wish I was reading individual Walking Dead,
you know,
all the stuff that they're doing. It's just so impressive to me, and they're a company that makes me go like, why do I have to wait for the trade for that, you know? Mm-hmm. But I do, because the costs are just going higher and higher. But it is definitely becoming, like, I know a while ago we talked about, like, what can comic shops or companies do? Like, this, to me, they're like almost the new Vertigo. They are the real deal. They've got intelligent stories, impressive writing, fantastic artwork. You can't get past it. And I hope that it's a company that is able to hold itself together with the way that they're doing business. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That Paul Pope book that you were pre-ordering, was that the one from Image?
Yeah.
I just noticed that. And yeah, and Saga, which Brian Vaughn's return to comics is a good book too.
Yeah.
So Image really sort of came, it seems like, from out of nowhere because for a long time, you know, they were just superhero books.
Yeah.
And, you know, but over the last, it's like 3 or 4 years, it seems, that like they've done a lot of really, really interesting novel work. And I'm happy that somebody like them is around.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, maybe a lot of it has to do with when they made Kirkman a partner, you know? I mean, gosh knows, you know, Robert, he doesn't need any more, you know, laurels placed upon his head. But I think that this real sort of renaissance within Image Comics might have started with him becoming a partner and him saying, like, this is what we got to do. Because for a long time, it really seemed like they were competing with what DC and Marvel were trying to do,
which absolutely is
compete in the superhero market. And they may not be the biggest comic book company out there, but at least they're taking strides to do something different. I mean, Marvel and DC are great. They're doing what they do. They're attracting who they attract. Maybe not all of their stuff is for me, but, you know, I got to say, Image to me this year stands out as, you know, the big deal, you know, along with, like, people like IDW and Titan Books and, you know, other Dark Horse Comics. But Image, for some reason, just, like, rises to the top as far as I'm concerned. So I don't know, but I, you know, between you and me, like you said, there's been a lot of great stuff in 2012. And the hard thing about being a part-time fanboy, having a job, having a family, you know, commitments, things to spend your money on, is the fact that, you know, there's so much good stuff out there right now.
Yeah, it's really funny. We live in a time where, you know, there's just so much good stuff. And it's some of it's readily available, some of it's not. You know, you really do have to. I think the hardest part is sort of finding the stuff, you know. Finding it and then, you know, maintaining good taste too. You know, I mean, not that there's anything wrong with, you know, the sort of modern, you know, blockbuster, you know, mass entertainment kind of thing like that, but, you know, like Stephen King, you know, once described himself as the literary equivalent of a Big Mac and fries. And, you know, and first, you know, I thought, oh, that's funny, you know, but I get it, you know. It's like, it's good once in a while, but, you know, you don't want to pull a Morgan Spurlock and, you know, eat that all the time.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And, you know, and one of the things I am reading right now, it's a reprint of an old book by Stephen King. It's called Dance Macabre.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a, you know, sort of his nonfiction look at the horror genre, you know, through movies and literature and everything, and just realizing, like, how many really good things are out there, you know, if only you sort of move outside of what you're comfortable with.
Yeah.
And, And I guess that's sort of my challenge here then in 2013 is for us to find some things that are good but sort of outside the norm of what we're used to seeing. And
yeah.
Fortunately for us, there are companies like Image that are putting out really interesting books that are creator-owned and are different than most of the stuff out there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we live in a very good time to be a fanboy, I am excited about 2013. I'm feeling positive and just really good about everything. So any other choices from 2012, or are we pretty much wrapped up here?
You know, we could probably go on for hours about 2012.
I know.
It was a good year, and I think that the next year is shaping up to be, if not as good, then definitely better.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, cool. Well, this has been our little look back at 2012, our favorite things, and another episode of Part-Time Fanboy. And I'm Christian, and that's Paul.
And, see you later.
Thanks for joining us. Zooby, zooby, zoo. Zooby, zooby, zoo. Zooby, zooby, zoo. Un, deux, trois, quatre. Qu'ils sont doux. Zoubizou.